Good morning, everybody. Welcome to NTWC Live. It is Wednesday, the 27th of July. Good to have you along today. Thanks to everybody who's watching us on all the various platforms, on Facebook, on our website, on Boxcast, Twitter, wherever you're watching. Thanks for tuning in this morning all around the world. Good to see you today. Our guest today is going to be Jim Alvey, the Vice President of Disaster and Recovery for Good 360. It's going to be a fascinating conversation. We've been kind of chatting a little bit already. I think it's going to be a great program today. We're all going to learn a lot about disaster and recovery and the effort that goes into it. A lot of the things that we don't think about very often, but there's a whole crew behind that recovery, making it happen. So we appreciate that. Hal Needham, Dr. Hal Needham's with us this morning. Let me say good morning to Hal and welcome you to the program. Good to see you. And Bill Reed's absence. Still glad to have you here, Hal.
Hey, great to see everybody. I'm really excited for today's show.
I think it's going to be good. You know, we're talking a little bit before about some of the interesting things about disaster and recovery. I'm anxious to hear it. How are things in Southeast Texas today? Did you get below 80 overnight?
You know, I think our low is 86. We've consistently started every day in the mid 80s. We've been up to about 93. I was talking to some people that like work on the beach. They said this year has been a little bit unusual in that it's just, you know, constant onshore wind, no calm days, very warm nights, but it's been unbelievably consistent within that. The weather hasn't really changed much since early June.
Your water, you had some really pretty water a couple of times this spring and into the summer. Has that become the norm with this warmer than normal weather, or is it not?
You know, I just did a saltwater swim this morning, and I could see my hands out there. Sometimes we get a high sediment load in the water up here. It's been really nice water. We've had some good blue water days. Water temperatures have been about 86 in the morning, about 89 in the afternoon. So a lot of warm water, a lot of fuel out there if something tropical does develop.
You know, it's interesting. You're 300 miles up the coast from where I am. I'm at South Padre. And here the water temperature in the surf is still in the upper 70s, like 77, 78 degrees, which amazing the difference between where I am and where you are.
You know what? Sometimes when we get this prolonged south wind, just the angle of the coast, water tends to deflect to the right of the wind. That's why on the northern part of the Yucatan Peninsula, sometimes we see these cool waters. You know, the east wind there, the water sometimes deflects to the right. It's pushing offshore and there's upwelling. You guys get quite a bit of upwelling down there by South Padre sometimes. That the cooler, the water's moving, the surface water's moving offshore, cooler water comes up. And sometimes your water temperatures will be in the mid to upper 70s.
And that's what it is right now. Fishermen love that because the cooler water is good for fishing. The big fishing tournament next weekend, we know there's going to be, they're looking forward to it. They're hoping to catch some nice blue marlin, things like that. Okay, let's do a quick tropical update, show you what's going on in the tropics and see what's going on today. So let me share my screen with you so you can see the latest. Let me start over here on this side. And this is what we love to see. Tropical cyclone activity not expected during the next 48 hours. If we go out to 5 days, same thing. No new tropical cyclones expected in the Atlantic Basin during the next 5 days from here to Africa. And as long as that's the case, everybody on the U.S. East Coast all the way down to Central America, happy and pleased that we're just waiting and waiting and waiting. We know that it'll change. Climatologically, we're right on track. We're right where we should be, climatologically speaking. On television here in South Texas, we were talking yesterday, the day before, 2 days ago, it was the anniversary of Hurricane Hanna, which is 2020. And that was the H storm on July 25th. And so far, we've only had ABC. So we're way behind 2020, but that was the most active season on record. So it's good to be behind that. Eastern North Pacific, a little bit happening. Frank, tropical storm and another developing system there that's going to try to move off to the southwest. We can show you where Frank is headed. Not a threat to land at all, but probably will become a hurricane sometime over the weekend. That'll send some nice surf up to the southwest coast of Mexico, perhaps up to southern tip of the Baja Peninsula, Cabo San Lucas, and San Jose del Cabo. They tend to get some pretty big surf when systems are out here. I saw it a couple of weeks ago for myself when Bonnie went by there. One of the factors right now, look at the dust. I mean, look at all that dust coming off Africa on the right side of the screen. Models are pushing some of that into the Gulf of Mexico, into Florida, and into Texas over the weekend, so we'll watch for that. And finally, I know Bill Reed's not with us this morning. He is in spirit. This is a rainfall map. He's right up here with his yellow and green area are in New Mexico. Finally happy that he's gotten some rain. they've been suffering just like we are in South Texas, but you can see that they finally got some rain. The monsoons have kicked in, so some pretty good rain. So in Bill's articles on it. I thought I'd share that map to show what's going on. So that's pretty much it. Otherwise, things are relatively quiet. Before we get to the program, I want to thank our sponsors, USAA, always a big part of what we do. Thanks to USAA for everything that they do. The South Padre Island Convention and Visitors Bureau, sponsor from the very beginning. That's our host for the in-person National Tropical Weather Conference. If you'd like to come and see all this that we're doing every week here on Wednesday mornings in person and live over a three-day period, join us on South Padre Island in April. We'll be there, and you are welcome to come. The Weather Company, Walmart, the City of Brownsville, Weather Boy, Black Magic Design, and the Port of Brownsville, all folks who helped make our event a possibility. And speaking of the Port of Brownsville, just noticed that Boca Chica Beach is now closed. They just got a text. That means SpaceX is doing some testing out there today. Boca Chica Beach is the home to SpaceX and Spaceport, and they close that beach pretty regularly so they can test. They're getting ready for a big launch out of Boca Chica Beach, going to launch the orbital spaceship, Starship here pretty soon. So I probably see that from where I'm sitting right now. So should be pretty cool. All right, let me go back to Hal, and Hal can introduce our guest today, Jim, and we'll get started. Hal, take it away.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jim. So excited to have you on the broadcast this morning. I want to just read through your impressive biography here. You've done a lot. Uh-oh. I know our listeners are going to get a lot out of this. As Good 360 Vice President, Disaster Recovery and Philanthropy, Jim Alvey cultivates relationships that expand Good 360's corporate donor network, increase nonprofit sector collaboration, and connect government and association entities. Jim's primary focus is product donations from manufacturers and retailers that support short and long-term disaster recovery efforts. Good 360 partners with corporate social responsibility, sustainability, and supply chain teams to help close need gaps identified by nonprofit partners. Jim also works with local, regional, and national foundations to amplify the impact of missions they support. Good 360 makes it easy for companies to donate product while helping nonprofits close need gaps in their communities. Their 100,000 plus nonprofit network member organizations benefit from the goods donated by corporate and foundation partners. Jim lives in the Baltimore, Washington area, where he's been a leader in broadcast and print media, direct marketing, data analysis, and nonprofit management. Jim, really an honor to have you here on the broadcast this morning. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I feel very fortunate to be able to be here.
Jim, you know, with this work you have, you know, you're really focusing a lot on product donations from manufacturers and retailers that are, you know, supporting short and long-term disaster recovery. How do you even plan for that? I mean, disasters are these mega events that often don't really come on a calendar often. How do you really plan and prepare for that?
Wonderful question, because just when we think we've got Mother Nature figured out, we figure out we don't, right? So there has been traditionally timeframes associated with different disasters, you know, fire season, hurricane season, tornado season. Recent events, as we were discussing earlier, like the winter storm Uri, the tornadoes in Kentucky in December, all throw those up in the air. So what used to be something you could prepare for logically, and there still is a hurricane prep period, but you really need to be prepared all year round for what might come your way. And we can talk about what that means in terms of preparation. But we try to be prepared for logical disaster impacts in areas likely to be impacted, is the best way to put it.
Yeah, that makes sense. And here we are, late July, really the heart of hurricane season in the U.S. We would say probably August and September. So, like, what are you doing now to prepare for this hurricane season?
So this is our busy season. You know, so one of the things that has been a common theme for the last couple of years is pre-positioning. It's not a new concept. It's just one that's kind of realized that the benefits, government agencies have always been doing this. Emergency managers have been pre-positioning product, for example, sand for ice storms. It's an example of pre-positioning. But we're taking it further, and we're trying to pre-position products that'll be needed in early response in the areas that are likely to be impacted. So what that means is things like hygiene kits for shelters or bottled water in those same areas. Depending on the disaster, what kind of cleaning products might be needed in those early phases, because it's different between flood, fire, hurricane, different kinds of products will be needed. Getting those in the hands of nonprofits that are in those areas. So for us right now, that means the coastal areas. We're very focused on Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, Florida, primarily, but also along the eastern coast.
So would this be like getting these supplies into these communities already, or would it be like staging maybe a warehouse in Orlando that could then go to, say, coastal communities?
Yeah, wonderful thinking. It's exactly that. It's both of them. The issue that we have seen over time is warehousing space being available. So it's all great to have a plan to have pre-positioned products, but if you have no place to put them, then you can't do anything. You're stuck. So one of the things we've done, we got a grant from the Center for Disaster Philanthropy, great organization based in Texas. And they are basically helping to fund us getting additional warehouse space. So we're working with nonprofit partners, with our corporate partners, 3PLs for lease space, getting warehouse space in those same areas we were discussing so that we can put products there. So it's a little bit of both. It's knowing, as we do, what the needs are going to be. Over time, we have kind of an evergreen list of response items, cleanup items, rebuilding items, and moving back items. And we know what those are going to be. Just getting them in place.
Yeah, Jim, a big part of this work is building relationships. Like, how do you do that year-round?
Yeah, and year-round is the key. The last thing we want to be doing, and it's cliche, but exchanging business cards in the middle of a disaster. So all the work that we do on the nonprofit side is done in advance. The partnerships that we have, because 360 can't do anything by ourselves. We're a matchmaker between companies that donate products and nonprofits that need products. So we're on our own, we're on an island. But if we establish those partnerships with companies that have products in excess or strategic giving, and on the other side, the network of nonprofits, national nonprofits like Red Cross, Salvation Army, Team Rubicon, those guys, but also on the regional and local level, establishing contacts with the individual nonprofits working in Louisiana, for example, right now, that nobody else has heard of but us, but we know they're going to be doing the work. It goes on year round.
Yeah, that makes sense. Jim, I was reading about the recovery efforts after the Indian Ocean tsunami in 2004, and tremendous amount of global resources went, you know, to the Indian Ocean area, Thailand, Indonesia, you know, all these countries. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of times they'd open shipments and there's winter clothing or something that people in a tropical area just don't need. Is that an issue that you face sometimes, getting things that people don't need? And then how do you deal with that?
It's a huge issue. It may be the number one issue in disaster other than the disaster. In fact, in many cases, what you just described is called the second disaster. In our world, we call that unsolicited goods. It means that nobody asked for that. If they had asked for it, it wouldn't have been unsolicited. It would have been solicited and it would have been needed. So it's a really big problem that we've seen. In Kentucky, for example, they received, because of the time frame that they were in, they received warehouses full of toys. The impacted number of homes was 500 to 1,000. So the numbers were way out of whack. Same thing with water. When the news media went out and said that water was the need, truckloads and truckloads and truckloads of water arrived that's still sitting in warehouses because it was too much to use. Now they're working the VOAD in Kentucky, Voluntary Organizations Active in Disaster. You may hear me refer to that. There's state-level VOADs, there's national VOAD, there's also COADs at the county level and smaller levels. But in this case, the Kentucky VOAD is redistributing that product within Kentucky to nonprofits that can use it. But that took a lot of effort and certainly caused wasted time and effort in the middle of an intense crisis. So, yeah, so unsolicited goods is a significant problem. So we highly recommend companies and individuals establish the need first before they do anything.
It sounds like you're saying unsolicited goods can actually add more burden on the people that are already in harm's way.
You got it. Yeah, because those volunteers that show up in mass numbers are often distracted, and the only thing they're tasked to do is move the stuff they don't need over here and get it out of the way and find some place to put it instead of going and doing hands-on mucking and gutting or whatever would be the more appropriate action for that volunteer. Yeah, it's definitely a huge problem. And it's not just a little bit. These come in truckloads and fill warehouses.
Jim, how do you plan out logistics when society may be breaking down? I mean, bridges may be washed out, you know, warehouses may be damaged or flooded. I mean, so how do you plan for contingencies like this?
Yeah, planning for them is tough, but trying to be aware of them. One of the things that we do, we have a great partnership with the UPS Foundation. They have their own internal tracking mechanisms. It's transportation is their business, so we lean on those kinds of partners. You'd be amazed at the kind of operation centers that companies like Walmart have because of their store locations. And it's important for them to keep business running. It's good for the community as well as for their business, obviously. They have a tremendous operation center where they're constantly tracking ability to get products from one place to another, what the obstacles are. And we lean on each other for that information to work around it. There's a will, there's a way. It's going to get there. But we are also very conscious of not putting volunteers in harm's way. So we time that appropriately.
Jim, we have a big focus with the National Tropical Weather Conference on weather forecasting, weather communication. So if there is a big storm coming out there, say a hurricane's approaching the coastline, I mean, what kind of weather data are you looking at? You know, what kind of information do you need and where are you turning for that?
Yeah, any place I can, first of all, because the sources vary. You all know this, the different models that can be thrown on a particular potential storm vary drastically. So I try to get as much and as many different sources as I can. One thing that we are doing, we're on a beta test program with IBM that's working on what they call Operation Risk Insights, ORI. It's a projection model that they hope to market to companies that would have the need to know more. We along with Team Rubicon and a couple of other nonprofits are helping beta test this projection model. So it's been amazingly accurate. So I use that in conjunction with, you know, Tropical Tidbits or any of the other media sources that have their own projections. NOAA obviously is a key player in that for us. So I try to take all the models, make our best projections. Fortunately for us, we're not on the ground. We just have to project where we're going to have to get product either shipped to or from. So we can be close, but not exact in our science.
What about after the event? I mean, there's a big hurricane impact. There's this rush to get resources there. And then what about, you know, a few months afterwards when things are winding down? What are the steps to kind of, you know, wrap things up in that area? Or are there ongoing efforts that extend even, you know, beyond months into the years ahead?
Yeah, I wish more people asked that question because that is kind of the untold story in disaster. The Center for Disaster Philanthropy, I think the number that they use now is about 12% of funding that goes to disaster goes towards long-term recovery. So this small percentage for the phase that lasts the longest, months and years, we definitely try hard to support those long-term recovery groups. We look at disasters by phase. So ahead of disasters is mitigation. So it's kind of a phase on its own, taking steps, as we've discussed, particularly around flooding. But then you've got response, which is sheltering, cleanup, which is mucking and gutting and that hardcore, you know, crisis cleanup type work. Then you've got rebuilding and then moving back into homes with furniture, mattresses. So we look at it through the lens of product that's needed and divide it into those categories, those phases. So that long-term phase, that past cleanup, rebuilding takes months and years. We're still working with people that were kicked out of their homes for Winter Storm Uri, for the storms from 2017 that you all are very aware of, the series of hurricanes from there were so devastating. We're still helping families get back into their homes from those events.
I remember in my early days of covering disasters on the ground, sometimes doing live broadcasts and people would come out. I thought, oh no, they're going to yell at me. And I was amazed how many times they said, thank you for, you know, there was such a media focus for 2 days and then everyone left. And, you know, we talked to family around the country and they didn't even know we're still hurting here. And it's, you know, weeks or months later. And it's interesting how appreciative people are when media, weather people, you know, response groups, people in disaster recovery stay.
Right.
Yeah. Anybody to stay and help them.
Yeah. There's another term, you know, I mentioned the voluntary organizations active in disaster, VOADs. But after that initial work is done, and we always say, as the cameras and the media leave, just the way you did, then long-term recovery groups are formed. So an LTRG is another acronym we use in the disaster recovery space. And it's really important because those are the folks that live there. Those are the nonprofits, the government entities, the individuals that are passionate about helping. They form what's called a long-term recovery group. And that group stays together till the end. So they stay together for years. And they're drastically under-supported because everybody's gone. Those are the groups that we listen hard for needs coming from them. From Hurricane Florence in South Carolina, we're still working with long-term recovery groups in the counties there to get them the products that they need, because, you know, rebuilding sounds easy, getting a home rebuilt, but it's not. It takes a long, long time, and they're done one at a time. And fires are even more drastic, because in a fire situation, you lose everything. It's not a matter of a flood damage or repairing a roof. You have to build from the ground up. So each different disaster has a longer term life cycle to it.
Sure. Tim, I wanted to shift over to you to see if you had any questions, or are there any questions that came in on the chat line yet?
There are some good ones coming in. Let me start with this. Talk about some of the partnerships, Jim, that you have, that you've built, that you've built over the years, and that are really strong, you know, you can count on. Disaster in and disaster out, if you will.
Happy to do that. You know, as you mentioned, your sponsors, we have our ongoing partnerships with companies that even form what we call a disaster recovery council. It's really an advisory group for Good 360. Includes United Airlines. I mentioned the UPS Foundation, RH, CVS Health, Ecolab. Going to forget somebody. Lowe's is on there. Lowe's, David Venables, who will be on this show at some point, and others. I'll think of some more as we go through. But there are those folks that get it. They understand the long-term aspect of recovery, and that they know that there's a need to respond early. But they also may be able to provide products. Coca-Cola has become a great partner of ours, but that product is really just response. It's early response, getting water in place, along with Keurig Dr. Pepper, getting water in the shelter areas. But those long-term partners like Tempur Sealy, who provides mattresses to us, and GAF, who provides shingles to us, those are the key players for that long-term recovery. And folks, companies you might not even think would be interested or involved, those have been our best, most passionate partners.
So how much of what you do is the pre-planning and putting stuff in place, and how much of it is reacting to that need that you get there and it's like, oh, we need this now?
Yeah. Every day we have what we call a huddle, and we look at what came in over the transom, you know, through our donation portal. We get some odd stuff. We have a 99% placement rate, which amazes me. So we get everything from shoes to shingles offered to us. And I don't think I've mentioned that probably 20% of what Good 360 does is disaster focused. There's another 80% of what Good 360 does as a nonprofit that is other 501c3 programs, need gaps that we're trying to help in communities across the country and across the world, if we have international partners that can help us in Ukraine. Response, for example. Most of our work is initially response. What did we get and who might need it? So it's kind of a push and pull. So in that case, somebody has given us product, so we're going to identify who needs it. Now, in other cases, we'll ask GAF for shingles to help us with a particular recovery effort that is short on shingles, and they will provide those to us if able, and we'll get those out. So what my partner in crime, Damian Morales, my disaster recovery manager, does is go out and determine what those needs are. Who's doing what where? Long-term recovery groups, FOAD partners, what are they doing? What do they need? And then we're constantly looking for what comes in. Where can we utilize that to meet the need that's most pressing?
And this is not just a U.S. thing. I mean, you're helping Ukraine, you're worldwide, it sounds like.
Yeah, we are. And when we say that, it really is through our partners. So Save the Children, for example, International Medical Corps. One of our strongest partners is Global Empowerment Mission, based out of Miami, Florida. We're doing fantastic things in Ukraine. And all we're doing is providing them with product, lots and lots of product. We've sent, probably over $50 million worth of product through Global Empowerment Mission to Poland, Hungary, and actually they're working in Ukraine. So we lean on our international partners to do the heavy lifting on the ground. But the key is for them to tell us what they need, and then we will get them as much of it as we possibly can.
So often, and you talked about this a little bit earlier, but so often it's a matter of fitting the need to the disaster, the need to what's going on. How do you get the word out effectively that, you know, we don't need a truckload of left shoes that were the display shoes? This is what we need. How do you get that word out?
Constant battle. It's a constant battle. I would love to have a partnership with you, for example, to use any outlet that has access to media that we can. Unfortunately, the media loves to dramatize things, and we'll use a couple of facts and then turn that into a problem. So that happened with toys and water in Kentucky. An example of it working well for the Miami condo collapse, the unfortunate tragedy that happened there, they did a fantastic job of letting the media know that they had it, they had everything they needed, don't send anything. They could have been bombarded with all kinds of unnecessary, unneeded, unsolicited products, but they weren't. So I think the key is getting the word out quickly to media outlets and having that resonate with companies and individuals that they're okay, don't send anything. It's something we're working on as a business sector in disaster to try to get better at it. We talk about it at every conference. What can we do differently? Open for suggestions on that, Tim, if you've got any.
Well, you've got a partnership now, so no problem here. At least in our part of the world, we'll get the word out. Some good questions coming in online. Let me ask some of those. Casper says, it sounds like an amazing effort. Is there any way for the general public to help volunteer with what you're doing in times of need?
Yeah, through our partners. So Good360 doesn't have a need for many volunteers. We do have a few in our warehouse operations. But typically what we look for is support either financially to cover costs of transportation or warehousing. But then we can connect individuals in their areas with efforts that are on the ground through our partners. So if you live in Louisiana and you reach out to me at Good360, I can make that connection with a nonprofit there if there's a need. Real time. There are groups like Team Rubicon who do this super effectively. They have a training program. You sign up with Team Rubicon. They put you through all kinds of training to be sure you're going to be safe in the field and can do something that's helpful. And then there are other partners that we have, All Hands and Hearts and SBP, that take it a step further. You can sign up as a volunteer for a day, a week, months. They have some volunteers that have been with them for years. And you know, they do go home eventually, they come back, but they have stayed with them with their program. So there are lots of different ways to get involved depending on the level that you're interested in. Again, we'll share my contact information and reach out to me and I can make connections.
You may have just answered this, but I'm going to ask it anyway because someone asked it online and says, who is it that organizes the long-term recovery efforts? And is there an example like with counties and things where these are led? Governments, yeah. Anybody else?
So that's what National VOAD tries to do is share best practices so that, again, that's the National Voluntary Organizations Active in Disaster. National VOAD shares best practices to the states, state VOADs. State VOADs then share best practices with their members who are nonprofits who are active in disaster. So best practices get shared. And then the typical pattern, you know, we're in that season. I think within a week or two, we'll have our first land impact of a hurricane. We'll hear through you that it's coming. So will those partners. A day before impact, they'll probably have a call, a VOAD call, where they share information about what they know, where the likely impact locations are, and start to project what those impacts might be, depending on the category that's being estimated. And then those calls continue twice a day for a couple of days, then daily, then weekly. And during that process, that plan that's being asked about, that long-term recovery plan, is being pieced together. It's very localized. Every situation is different. Each nonprofit organization and government entity has their own mission. Crisis cleanup identifies what the damage is to structures. Others focus on food. Others focus on building, reconstruction, or behavioral issues or legal issues. There's a whole team of nonprofit support that's out there all being aggregated at the VOAD level, state VOAD level. So that would be my answer. Then sadly, that focus does fade, and then those long-term recovery groups that I mentioned kind of take over from there for that real long-term recovery, and they focus on individuals. There's case management that's done so that individuals identified, what are their needs, do they have insurance or not, and that kind of thing. So it's pretty detailed. FEMA helps enormously, although you'll hear that it's a complex system and difficult for individuals to find their way in. They have evolved. And nonprofits are now stepping in to help individuals to figure out how to deal with FEMA and also state agencies and to be able to better maximize the benefits that are available to them. But it's a complicated process. I think that there's more focus needed on that side of education around disasters.
Just to let people know what's going on. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
One other question from online real quickly, then I'll go back to Hal for a minute. With the supply chain issues we've been having, how has that impacted donations?
Yes. Sadly, that's a wonderful question because dramatically. We have furniture partners who would love to help us and have helped us in the past, who are just not getting enough furniture for them to sell and then have furniture available to strategically share. And that goes through all of the major products, shingles, flooring, furniture, building supplies. All of that is in short supply, which means that there's no access. So the companies that are able to help us are those that strategically built in some disaster response into their budgets so that they can actually cover that. Lowe's is an example of that. Fantastic partner who has set aside funding so that they can help in disaster and help with product, funding and product. So they're helping us in both ways there. But the supply chain issues, boy, we really hope that they resolve themselves sooner than later so that that big need that's going to come if we have back-to-back hurricanes, that would be a serious problem because there will simply not be any supply for the critical needs.
Each answer brings up 1,000 more questions, but let me give a chance for Hal to jump back in again. Before we do that, we want to thank USAA and South Padre Island Convention and Visitors Bureau, two of the sponsors that make this a possibility. USAA, obviously involved in disaster response in many, many ways and have been a part of this program for a long time. We appreciate them. And the South Padre Island CBB host to this conference, and we hope that we continue to be there and that we don't have to deal with any hurricanes there anytime soon. So let's hope another year passes. Hal, jump back in. I've got more questions, but I'm going to get you back involved and we can kind of go around in circles here.
Yeah, for sure. I love the back and forth. Jim, you mentioned a lot of organizations donating goods. What about organizations donating space, like warehouse space, things like that? Has that ever been beneficial?
Probably more beneficial than the products at this point. Yeah, again, the largest need gap in disaster is warehouse space. So we have some great examples of how that's worked. I mentioned GAF a couple of times because they're a great partner. They're the North America's leader in shingles production. But what they did, for example, is they had a space that they vacated in Mobile, Alabama, was a production space, was a warehouse. They moved production elsewhere and it was just sitting there, kind of an eyesore in the community. They asked us if we could use it and helped us clean it up, get it operational. We put one of our nonprofit partners in there, and now that's serving to house both early response and long-term products. It's a huge space because it was a production facility, so it's been phenomenal. We also have offers of space from partners like Ryder and companies you may not know in the space like ARS, who provides logistics support in disaster. They've offered us space in 5 different locations. Not a lot. We don't need a lot for response items. For that early response, it's 5,000 square feet is plenty. And then also larger groups like even Amazon, who has fulfillment centers that have closed, is working with us to see if there are areas that make sense that we could work with together there. And those are gigantuan spaces. So those would be really helpful for that long-term recovery.
Jim, do companies ever donate transportation or trucking services as well?
We do. Again, we're super fortunate to have the UPS Foundation as a primary partner of ours, both in funding and what we call in-kind service. So every year they give us a grant of in-kind service space that rather service funding, so that I'll submit a request to them. We want to get this product moved for this disaster event, whether it's pre-positioning or active, and they come through every time for us. So really, really fortunate on that front. The funding that we collect outside of that from other foundations primarily goes to the shipping, and shipping has increased dramatically over the last 3-4 years. So it takes up a big chunk of our funding. So we could use more in-kind shipping service for sure.
Jim, another question. I've been in hurricane zones where all of a sudden your cell phone doesn't work. The towers are down. How do y'all deal with communicating if your cell phone signal isn't working? Has that ever happened? Any advice on how others can deal with that, and how do you deal with that?
Yeah, there's a group, a nonprofit, ITDRC, that focuses on communications. They get there as early as they can. Hurricane Ida was an example of that. You know, we think that the U.S. is immune to problems related to disasters like electricity, communications, clean water, but Hurricane Ida hit all those buttons. We had all those issues, which makes it unsafe for volunteers, makes coordination difficult on the ground because nobody knows what the other is doing. So ITDRC, don't ask me what that stands for, but they're a fantastic group. They focus on it. Verizon and AT&T also have teams that get on the ground early to help with communications. So again, everybody's got a specialty mission. We try not to overlap if we can help it, so that keeps the lanes clear. But we also work much, much more closely and collaboratively than we ever have before across all those nonprofits. So there's great team efforts. Communication comes up. We identify the issue, and one of those groups takes care of it for us.
Thank you so much. A lot of great insights, you know, to learn how you're doing this, but then also how some of our partners and our listeners can kind of follow along and have insights as well. Those are all the questions I have right now. Tim, let's get back to you. Tim, is that a heavy downpour I hear in the background there? And,
I thought I heard Don't something we wish. Behind you.
Okay, I just wanted to ask.
Don't we wish? No, that's the dog back there. it has to be part of the program, you know. So that water you're drinking is about the only water we're going to see around here for a while. Huh? I do see a cloud out the window. Jim, let me ask you this. You know, you plan for hurricanes. You know there's going to be hurricanes. You know there are going to be wildfires. You know there are going to be tornadoes, disasters. Is there anything that in the years you've been there has surprised you? It's like, oh, we didn't expect this one.
Yeah, the derecho. I didn't know that term. You guys probably knew about it, studied in school, knew kind of waiting for one. That threw me for a loop. I had to study up on what caused it. The damage it had was significant across multiple states. It's another area that we're working still to help rebuild the homes and put roofs back on that were torn off for that. I think that every year we've got those oddball floods that happen in places we wouldn't expect them. You know, like Hurricane Ida's flooding in Pennsylvania and New York, we just weren't expecting that. And tornadoes that occur, like the ones in December for Kentucky and Tennessee, those were significant, but they were among hundreds of thousands, as you know, that happened in those seasons, kind of out of season for a tornado. Those keep us going. There are things, events that we call unnamed disasters. So those are those ones that they're not a named storm. They're not a hurricane or even any level that gets a name to it. It might not even be identified by FEMA as an event, but tears apart a community. So Waverly, Tennessee was one of those where it was just referred to as the floods in Waverly, Tennessee. The entire town was flooded out. We're still working there because it was an anomaly. And fortunately, there were some folks that lived there that raised attention to it. They got good support, and recovery is well underway there. But those pop up across the country, and not everybody's so fortunate to have that sort of celebrity status around funding and around attention from the media. Lots of unnamed, unattended to disasters. Our friends and partners in West Virginia are hit constantly. They're working now on an event that just happened last week. Probably nobody else even knows about, but it's taken all their attention.
Well, we're seeing flooding in St. Louis this week. I'm sure that you'll have some role there at some point. Unprecedented flood, not unprecedented, but it's been 100 years since they've seen flooding like this. So I'm sure you'll end up there in some form as well.
And Tim, you probably heard this as much as we have. You know, it seems like every event now is a 100-year or a 1,000-year event. I don't know what to say about that.
Unprecedented as far as we know. We'll go with that.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, we all have benchmark things in our minds, things that, you know, stand out as the event, you know, the hurricane, the whatever. What's something like that for you? What's an event that just, you go, oh yeah, that was the one?
2017. You know, I really just started in the disaster space when I joined Good360. I originally was just going out after product, any product that was donated to that would help serve a need. But I joined the disaster recovery team and really appreciated that space only a few months before we had Harvey, Irma, Maria, even Jose that year. So that series of events is still referred to in our space as kind of like that turning point. People were paying attention to hurricanes and disaster, at least in this modern era, before that. But 2017 really rallied the troops and told us that we weren't prepared. We need to do better at this. We need to work together. And a lot of activity happened after that. A lot of really positive things have happened collaboratively. Teams of partners that have never worked together before are now working together, communicating. A lot of mitigation. We weren't even talking about mitigation before 2017, except at a governmental level. Nonprofits are now working to help prepare for fire season, for example. All Hands and Hearts has got teams in the field in California clearing brush and trees ahead of fire season. We're doing a lot more of that, again, because of 2017's events that were so dramatic. We also learned about funding in those years where the cycle began, where the early events will receive the most attention because everybody's kind of waiting for that first big one. Is it the one? Is there going to be another? And a lot of funding and attention goes to that first disaster. That definitely happened with Harvey. And then Irma and Maria did not see that funding support that Harvey received. And so we all became more aware about the need to be conscious that this isn't the only one. There's another one's going to come, be prepared. And as you referenced earlier, thinking more year round about disaster. So 2017.
You talk about the partnerships, you know, and all the goods and supplies and transportation, but I'm guessing there's still a need for money, you know, for cash. And where does that come from?
Yeah, there is a need for funding. And in fact, it's not just Good360. In the disaster space, we always support the need for funding. Nonprofits know what they need to do, and they know what they need to have to do that. Individual survivors, as we call them in the space, know what they need. So they're going to tell those nonprofits what they need. So the best thing anybody can do is donate money to a reputable charity. So the key is making sure that you identify a nonprofit that's working in that recovery space, that knows what they're doing, has integrity, has a track record. Support them with funding and let them do what they do. Trying to solve the problem by figuring out what products from your closet or your warehouse might be helpful isn't as impactful as cash. For Good360, we use that funding to do multiple things. Pay for warehousing, like we've talked about in those spaces that don't have warehouse space, cover the cost of transportation. And in some cases, we actually buy product. So we just did that with Lowe's. We purchased insulation through a program with them for recovery in Hurricane Ida. So we'll purchase product that isn't donated, but is critically needed and isn't going to come from anyplace else. So funding is absolutely important. Currently, we go to foundations, primarily both corporate foundations, some of those partners I mentioned before, as well as regional foundations. You know, like the Miami Foundation in Florida is really good about disaster recovery and support.
You led right into the next question. Where does your funding come from? You operate on a budget, and where does that money come from? And those foundations are the answer, it sounds like.
Foundations are the answer. Good360 has two models. One is our disaster model. One is our what we call our core. So our regular nonprofit business model, if you will, is that we have an admin fee that the nonprofits pay a very small percentage of fair market value, like 2% of the fair market value of the product that they're getting. That keeps us above board and has for over 39 years. But on the disaster side, we don't want those nonprofits paying a dime for shipping or for an admin fee or anything. They're doing the hard work on the ground. That grant funding goes to cover our costs so that they don't have to give us any funding from their side. So it's really critical for us to have that ability to help, especially in the funding world, we call it discretionary funding. So a CarMax, for example, who's not going to donate cars to us, but supports us financially, allows us to react the way that we know we need to because we have funding to do it. So we're really grateful to companies like CarMax, Booz Allen Hamilton, others that support us only with funding.
Another good comment coming online from one of our friends, Barry. He says that in the emergency management community, they use the phrase imagining the unimaginable. And that really helps to get people thinking outside the box in terms of how they're going to help.
Yeah, that's really true. And I have great respect for emergency managers across the country. I've gotten to be particularly friendly with those in Texas, TDAM as they're referred to. But across each of the states that we work with, they have been setting the standards for obviously emergency management, but also some of the ideas around prepositioning, mitigation, those things that are going to help us in the long term. We haven't talked about it, but resilience is a word that comes up a lot in disaster space. Resilience means, in our minds, the ability to bounce back faster, getting somebody back into their homes more quickly, getting money in their hands more effectively, more efficiently. So resilience is a key factor. And again, those emergency managers have known that all along and have been trying to make their communities more resilient.
Talk a little bit about if, Joe Corporate America is watching right now or listening right now and he wants to make a difference. How does he get a hold of you guys to make that difference?
Yeah, I love that. Lots of ways. And some of the ways are not even product or funding. We're about what we call thought leadership in the space, getting people to think, like you just said, imagining the unimaginable, but also applying some tenets to that. So, we'll provide my contact information, but what I really would love is for companies and those individuals in control of decision-making to think about what we call resilient response and super high level, six things, really logical. So the first one is being proactive, doing what we're doing now, talking about things before a hurricane hits. That's being proactive, get your partners in place, making sure that any giving is needs-based. So finding partners that can tell you what's needed, not just guessing. Focusing on both short-term and long-term. We've talked about the need for both response and recovery. Being educational. So whatever they learn, sharing with their customers, their associates, their stakeholders, being transparent about what their commitments are to it. And then the last one is that word we just used, resilience, building some form of resilience into the work that's done, supporting nonprofits that use shingles that are of a higher grade that'll last longer, or building techniques that are a fortified building that is going to guarantee they withstand the next hurricane, flood, or fire. So there's ways that the companies can participate more thoughtfully. Of course, we'll also take the funding and the product, but there's a pledge they can do with no cost called the Resilient Response Pledge, and we'll make that available to be shared. Just go on and they just provide their logo and say, yes, we're gonna strive to do the things that I just mentioned, and that will move us forward, just thinking differently about how to respond to disaster.
To steal a political phrase that's being used right now, build back better. When you go in and rebuild, when you're helping communities rebuild, you try to make it stronger and more resilient than it was before the disaster happened.
I hope that doesn't get politicized because I love that. I use that as well. It's exactly that. Build back better. It could be build back smarter if we have to change it, right? But it just means, think about the materials that are being used, how they're being used, where they're being used, and also the communities that have been impacted and how to involve them in the process. One of the big discussions in our space is that particularly the folks that are uninsured and don't have political clout are left out of the discussions. Sometimes that boils down to demographics, and they need to be included in the discussions because it's their homes that are being built back or moved in some cases. So, building back better has lots of different meanings to it, and levels and layers, government entities working with nonprofits, working with the individuals in those communities, key.
We'll get back to Hal to see if there's any final questions. But before I do that, you're in the Baltimore, Washington area, right?
Correct.
So probably the most important question of the day, is it Orioles or Nationals?
How dare you ask that question?
Jim, you know how we were talking about building back better? I think that's the answer.
Building back better. I will say that this week there's a lot of interest in the Orioles, who are no longer in last place by a half game. So we're really excited about that. And the Nationals, you know, we're hoping that they can bounce back from a couple of tough years as well. So, yeah, we go with who's ever got the fighting chance. We have Battle of the Beltway, where the teams meet, and we go back and forth between the stadiums. It's kind of fun.
I've been to games in both stadiums. They're both great places to watch baseball, whether it's good baseball. And the only Grand Slam I've ever seen in person was in Washington, at a Nats game.
Great place. Now try to see one in Camden Yards, also phenomenal.
I've been to a game, but no Grand Slams. How about else you have?
You know, we were talking about building back better. I love that concept. Is there ever pressure, though, where people say, hey, I love that idea, but I'm homeless? You know, I just need something to move back into next week. Sometimes do you find pressures where people say, I love the concept of building higher and building stronger, but I need something now? I mean, how do we merge those ideas? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a challenge from both sides. So you'll have, sadly, nonprofits who are not well-trained doing the best they can with construction, with their selection of products and the way that they're installed, which aren't necessarily the best. So you've got that challenge. You've also got, on the other side, what you mentioned, individuals who are just desperate for a roof on their house. You know, it's amazing to go to these areas that have been impacted by wind-related disasters and see blue tarps when you fly over the area and you say, what's all that blue roof down there? And you realize that they have had blue tarps on their roofs for years. Puerto Rico, Florida, Baton Rouge area, lots of these areas that are just kind of getting by. So to your point, if somebody offered them a roof, they wouldn't ask any questions. They would take whatever they got. Same thing with flooring, walls. We see that they are particular about their household goods and their furniture, which, you know, that's their priority. But yeah, I think that it's a real fine line trying to provide enough. You know, we go by the good, better, best model, where just getting a roof over their heads first, nothing can happen without a roof. You're wasting your time working on the interiors and getting furniture or anything in. You got to have a secure roof. You start there, and then you work your way through that case management to find out what the real needs are. And the nonprofits do a great job of identifying that. And I will say that I'm sure that those nonprofits that I'm familiar with do a really good job of convincing folks to go with the right selections and options.
Yeah, Jim, one last question. And by the way, South Texas might be the one place in the world you could get by without a roof. It's never going to rain again. So that's just if you ever have a storm down there, that might be the one exception. The last thing, I was in Hurricane Michael in 2018, and there was a community leader that was running basically a donation space in a church. He had done this many years. And I always ask people, what do you need and what did you learn? And he said, Hal, he said, what I learned, I can't believe I got blindsided. The community right now is sharing information 24 hours a day on the radio about where to go for this, where to go for that, when there's a curfew. And he said, you know, I just got so used to streaming radio on my phone and the cell phone towers are down. He said, I can't believe I don't have an AM FM radio. Have you ever run into that, where maybe radio is being used in some of these communities? Is that a useful thing at times?
It is, and other applications. So Nextdoor app has evolved as one of the best communication devices. If you're not familiar with it, it allows a community to log in, create a location-based communication, whether you want it to just be your street, your neighborhood, your city, broader areas. Some of the best information comes from those channels, people that live there and are being impacted by it. So radio, radio is actually one of the best ways to get the most efficient, and I would say untainted information. I think radio is still, they're reporting live from the scene, and the actual information that you need, it's critical. It's amazingly hard to get direct information about locations, impacts, places to go. It shouldn't be that hard. So that's another area of focus for the VOADs, is communication to survivors about how to get to what's needed. But I think that initial period that you're referring to about impacts and projections, more work could be done there to make people aware where they can go for channels of information.
Those were all the questions I had. Jim, it was a pleasure to meet you, and I learned a lot from your insights today.
Well, I love the focus that your team has on weather. It's not just, you know, how's the weather today? It's let's pay more attention and what we can do around it. We'll never be able to control Mother Nature, but we can certainly work with her.
Jim, do you have any last comments on if people want to get involved, they want to learn more about what you're doing, what can they do?
Yeah, absolutely. My email, and if you can share it in some other form, great, but it's jalvey, A-L-V-E-Y, at good360.org. So jalvey at good360.org. Would love to have additional questions if anybody has them, ideas on some of the topics that we touched on, because that imagining the unimaginable is, we can only do that by getting our shared brain power together. Would love that. But just kind of keeping those principles that I mentioned about resilient response in mind, and supporting the nonprofits that need the help with funding primarily, and then those companies that I mentioned, supporting them so they can support us.
Terrific program, Jim. Thank you so much. Really appreciate your time today, and good luck to both your baseball teams.
Thank you.
And Hal, thank you again, as always. Very insightful questions. We appreciate all you're doing on that, and Hal and Galveston as well. Thank you so much. And thanks to our sponsors who make this program a possibility. USAA, thank you, USAA. We couldn't do it without you. You stayed with us through the pandemic. We pivoted to virtual. You were there for us, and we appreciate that. The same for the South Padre Island Convention and Visitors Bureau. We encourage all of you watching to join us in person again in April of 2023 on South Padre Island at the Marriott Courtyard for another great conference and a lot of fun at the same time. We try to make sure you have a good time while you're there. The Weather Company, Walmart, City of Brownsville, Weather Boy, Black Magic Design, the Port of Brownsville, all sponsors that make this event a possibility. Next week, Heather Legrone from the Texas General Land Office will be with us at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, so we encourage you to join us. And very quickly, Hal, is there a program you wanted to promote that's being recorded this week? Is there anything you want to say about that?
Yeah, there is. You know, I have a weekly podcast that focuses on extreme weather and disasters. It's called the GeoTrek Podcast, and we have a very special episode next Monday. We're going to be talking about the National Tropical Weather Conference. Tim, you and Alex are going to be joining me on the podcast, but that's just called the GeoTrek Podcast, and it's stories every week about extreme weather, disasters, resiliency. We're always learning a ton on that podcast. It's basically like a radio show that you can listen to while you're driving in your car, called the GeoTrek Podcast.
Try not to run you off the road with our answers to your questions.
I'm excited to hear really the backstory of the National Tropical Weather Conference, you know, how you guys got this started and just what you've learned. I'm really excited to hear more about the story behind everything we're doing right here.
This is a 4-hour podcast, right? We've got
time. They're pretty short. They're about 40, 45 minutes. And it's a lot of fun. We cover all hazards, not just hurricanes, you know, ice storms, wildfire, drought, the whole gamut.
Thanks, Hal. We appreciate it. And we'll see you on that show. We encourage you to tune in and check it out. Jim, again, thank you. Hal, thank you. Alex Garcia, thanks for running things back at the control room. We appreciate it. We'll see you guys next week with Heather Legrone, Wednesday at 10 a.m. Until then, take care. Bye-bye.
Loved what you've heard on this week's episode? Well, the answer is simple. It would mean the world to us if you could head over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review and feedback. Spreading the word really is the best way to grow our podcast and achieve even greater things. Thank you.